All right. I'll tell you why the girl gives me the creeps.
HPPodcraft.com.
Why I can't stand to go downtown and see the mob slavering up at her on the tower with that pop bottle or pack of cigarettes or whatever it is beside her. Why I hate to look at magazines anymore because I know she'll turn up somewhere in a brassiere or a bubble bath. Why I don't like to think of millions of Americans drinking in that poisonous half smile. It's quite a story. More story than you're expecting. No, I haven't suddenly developed any long-haired indignation at the evils of advertising and the national glamour girl complex. That'd be a laugh for a man in my racket, wouldn't it? Though I think you'll agree there's something a little perverted about trying to capitalize on sex that way, but it's okay with me. And I know we've had the face and the body and the look and whatnot else, so why shouldn't someone come along who sums it all up so completely that we have to call her the girl and blazon her on all the billboards from Times Square to Telegraph Hill? But the girl isn't like any of the others. She's unnatural. She's morbid. She's unholy.
Unnatural, morbid, and unholy. Sounds like a Dracula to me. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about The Girl with the Hungry Eyes by Fritz Leiber, and we're talking about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Fife.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and I'm a Belieber.
You are, that's right!
We're here at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon. Who was that reader?
Why, that was my good friend and fellow Illinois expatriate straight out of Galesburg. It's Nick Viena. No, he is not named after the Ultravox song. Nick is a great actor. He's a great guy. I'm very glad to finally have him on the show.
Thank you, Nick!
This is yet another story I grabbed from my Penguin Book of Vampire Stories. And here's what the editor, Alan Ryan, our good friend Alan Ryan, had to say. Some of this bio on Leiber we've covered before, since we've done a few stories of his and grossly mispronounced his name in the past.
Yeah.
Fritz Leiber Jr., the son of a noted Shakespearean actor, was born in Chicago in 1910. He had a short career on the stage himself and later appeared in several films. In 1939, he began publishing stories that have long since secured his reputation as one of the true masters of horror fiction, a position acknowledged with the Life Achievement Award presented to him in 1976 at the Second World Fantasy Convention. Don't know if we've mentioned that before. Leiber's work has spanned science fiction, fantasy, and sword and sorcery, but it is as a writer of horror fiction that he is likely to be remembered. Among his novels are such modern classics as Conjure Wife, which we should maybe cover at some point.
Yeah.
Gather Darkness and Our Lady of Darkness. Among his more memorable stories, many of which deal with the terrors of modern urban life, often as Leiber witnessed them from his own San Francisco apartment, are Smoke Ghost, like that title, Gonna Roll the Bones, which we have done, and especially The Girl with the Hungry Eyes. Of course, that intro was written before Leiber's passing in 1992. He had a brief and very intense correspondence with H.P. Lovecraft starting in 1936, which I'm sure we mentioned before. Of course, that was cut short in 1937 when Lovecraft passed away. His first stories were also published by John W. Campbell. And his first book in 1947 was called Night's Black Agents, which you'll recognize as also being the title of Kenneth Haidt's role-playing game, Night's Black Agents, which is also about Dracula's. See, I'm bringing it back. But the story's amazing. Let's get into it.
This story is told to us by a photographer, Dave. That's all we get for his name. As it's written, it feels like we're talking to him in a crummy bar, and he's telling us the story on a Tuesday afternoon, already halfway there.
Yeah.
Feels very noir.
This is the late 40s, so it's smack dab in that noir period. So I think that's why it comes off that way. And but it really makes me thirsty for more stuff from that period. We just don't get this on the show very often. You know, we've covered Dashiell Hammett's Creeps by Night anthology, but we've never done any actual stories by Hammett or Raymond Chandler or James Cain. And these authors really took those modern writing styles that were birthed in the 20s and mixed them all up with the despair and disillusionment of the Depression and World War II to create a really special genre that I think is uniquely American. You know, in writing, it's almost like the jazz of America, because I mean both the writing and the film adaptations. Noir, I think, is about, at its core, it's about peeling away layers of artifice to reveal the dirty, ugly secrets beneath. And it's why these are often presented as detective stories. It reveals America as this nasty dystopia that just happens to have great PR. And I think many of these stories are set in California for that reason.
Sure.
Sun, celebrity, sex, but what dwells in those dark shadows? And I also think it's because of that dark secret element of noir that it lends itself very well to supernatural stories, and the two have cross-pollinated basically since the beginning of the noir genre. You had a good breakout of the noir genre back in the day, I remember. You summarized it as women are weak, men are stupid. You're like, that's every noir movie. But it's pretty astute, because the stories do go that way a lot. You don't even need a gender component, honestly. It's just person A has a dodgy plan. Person B gets on board with it, usually because they're attracted to the person. And that's a stupid thing to do. And then person A screws up the plan because they're weak in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody gets in trouble. And it's the weak leading the stupid. Which is maybe why we recognize it as uniquely American. That should be the slogan of this country. The weak leading the stupid. But Liber is showing the classic horror underpinnings in that intro as well, right? Because it's the ruined man beginning. It's this. Some horrible things happened to me, trashed my life, and now I'm going to issue my warning to you by giving you the story. Which is, that's about as classic Lovecraftian weird fiction as you can get.
Yeah, of course.
It's as old as the horror genre.
He's telling us that it is 1948. People don't believe in vampires, obviously. But not all vampires drink blood. He hints at murders, but moves on to the fact that there is some cover girl that America is gaga over. But no one knows anything about her. She has never been interviewed, and she's never been in movies. She's only been photographed, and just by a single photographer.
He wonders, why haven't the movies snapped her up? Why don't we read about her tastes and hobbies or views on the Russian situation? Finally, and this is the real killer, why hasn't she ever been drawn or painted? Oh, that was really interesting. He goes on to say that any paintings of her were done from photographs.
Yeah.
She's not been painted in the flesh. And this was an interesting inversion of vampire myth, you know, because instead of not showing up in photographs, she only shows up in photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And this photographer that's doing the snapping, he says, it's one poor damned photographer who's making more money off her than he ever hoped to in his life and who's scared and miserable as hell every minute of the day.
He doesn't know who the photographer is, but he knows the type of guy. In fact, he used to be that guy.
Right, and that's how he knows all this. Because last year, I was that poor damned photographer I was telling you about. Yes, last year in 1947, when the girl made her first poisonous splash right here in this big little city of ours.
So this was 1947. He had a little studio in the city, a rat hole building. Business was lousy. He was hard up for some cash.
I'm not sure if this is New York or San Francisco, but I'm pretty sure it's San Francisco.
Yeah.
But our guy had recently quit a job at a studio at that time, and he was working for himself.
It was a dark gray afternoon just after one of Dave's other models left that this woman showed up.
She was wearing a cheap, shiny black dress, black pumps, no stockings. And except that she had a gray cloth coat over one of them, those skinny arms of hers were bare. Her arms are pretty skinny, you know, or can you see things like that anymore? And then the thin neck, the slightly gaunt, almost prim face, the tumbling mass of dark hair, and looking out from under it, the hungriest eyes in the world. And that's the real reason she's plastered all over the country today, you know. Those eyes. Nothing vulgar, but just the same, they're looking at you with a hunger that's all sex and something more than sex. That's what everybody's been looking for since the year one. Something a little more than sex. Well, boys, there I was, alone with the girl, in an office that was getting shadowy in a nearly empty building, a situation that a million male Americans have undoubtedly pictured to themselves with various lush details. How was I feeling? Scared.
At the time, when she first came in, he wasn't thinking about sex. He felt dizzy. Her voice, he noticed, wasn't cultivated. I'm not sure what he means by that. Does he mean that she's working class?
Yeah. Well, he could just tell that she's not from a wealthy background and doesn't know how to fake it. I think that's what it is. It's like you both are not from a wealthy background. And in addition to that, you're not very urbanized because you haven't been, you don't sound very cultivated. So
right. She's
probably got some colloquial phrases. She probably sounds Midwestern or something like that. She was talking like Carrie Fisher from the second half of Star Wars rather than the first half of Star Wars.
So she asked if he needed a model, and he said, I only work with professionals. Mm-hmm. A crappy model can ruin a shoot, of course, because they shot on film, so you don't know what you get until after the film is developed.
Although a good photographer hopefully will know a little if he or she's getting good stuff, but it's hard to find good models and actors. From the other side, it probably seems like the easiest job in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's billions of people willing to do it, but people who can really live in front of the camera, you know, while being photographed, have this weird relationship with the lens. It's a special talent.
Yeah.
It's interesting where she comes in and he doesn't find her particularly remarkable, but when you look at the photos, it comes out. She shows up with no portfolio or anything, so he doesn't have any idea about this yet. It says, she gave me a vague sort of story and I began to check her knowledge of model agencies and studios and rates and whatnot, and pretty soon I said to her, look here, you never modeled for a photographer in your life. You just walked in here cold. Well, she admitted that was more or less so. You know, remember, this is 1947. There's no America's Next Top Model yet.
No.
I could have faked it based on that show. I'd have been like, this is my third go-see today. So I'd throw some lingo around.
She just calmly and confidently told him that she thought she can do it. He said, all right, I'll take a few pictures. If I sell them, you'll get the standard rate. He had her put on a girdle, and he expected that she would be put off by this request, but she wasn't. He took more pictures and then some of a beach scene. I guess he had a backdrop and some sandy dog poop or something to make it authentic. I don't know.
I go to the beach quite a lot, and I can tell you that what you need for an authentic beach scene is two crazy guys arguing about demons, which is what I saw down there last week. If your backdrop doesn't have that, it's no good, and I'm looking at you, Olin Mills.
Oh.
Last time I went there, there were no crazy guys in the backdrop.
The whole time, he was feeling dizzy. Maybe it was the lights or the chemicals. He was just kind of off.
In all seriousness, the last few times I've been down at the beach, there's been a gorgeous girl, a different girl every time, shooting an Instagram or YouTube video where they just talk to the camera like about their crazy life. I mean, I'm just walking by, so I get a snippet of it, you know, but they're reviewing beauty products or whatever it is. It's that straight to camera YouTube influencer thing. And I think it's because right where I'm turning, there's a sweet spot where you can see the pier in the background. You can see some of the palm trees and the beach, but none of the public structures from that angle. It looks like it's your mansion's private beach or something like that, I think, is why they're shooting it, because you can't tell they're in a public area.
I see.
It's almost like, do you remember Don LaPree, that infomercial guy?
Of course, yeah.
He used to run those cable commercials. But I was able to make $50,000 a week by placing tiny classified ads from my one-bedroom apartment. He was selling people on this rich lifestyle, and you'd always see him in front of mansions and yachts. But, of course, you never saw him on the inside because they were all stolen shots. Like, they found, you know, they reported on him later. He would just drive by places and shoot himself in front of them and pretend they were his properties, which you really can't get busted for doing. Yeah. There's some rules in advertising. But like most advertising, he was doing that. Advertising is a lie to get you to buy something you don't need. So he was falling in with that. And, of course, his bad business practices, however, sad ending to that story. I don't know if you know about this.
No.
He moved on into doing nutraceuticals, you know, which are like non-FDA approved, you know, medicine. Which he made some claims for, which were not provable, and he got in a lot of trouble. They locked him up. He cut his own throat in jail while he was awaiting trial in 2011. Committed suicide. Don LaPree, son of Providence, Rhode Island. My whole point with the side road really was, when those influencers are shooting at the beach, there's always some poor guy standing there. I'm talking about these girls on the beach now. There's always some poor guy standing there holding the phone, shooting, looking miserable. Like, every time I've been down there, some schlep. And maybe it's some aspiring cinematographer. Maybe he's doing it because he wants to get better at shooting. But I don't think so. You know, I think 9 times out of 10, I know why that guy's holding the camera. It's for the same reason that this guy, Dave, you know what I mean? It's like they both are sexually interested in the subject and also kind of profiteering on it, perhaps.
Yeah.
Back to when this guy, Dave, met this 1940s future influencer. They did the shoot. He dressed her in some lingerie for this lovely belt client he's been shooting for. She didn't mind putting the stuff on. They finished up. Didn't really realize what he had yet, though.
He told her to write down her name and phone number. The whole time, she seemed calm and at ease. She wasn't like a nervous little Nelly. She was just this totally chill woman. Mm-hmm. He developed the pictures and he put them in a stack of others that he was going to try and sell the next day.
He says that on an impulse, he threw them in with his photos. Like, it was random. I didn't really mean to do it, which makes me wonder if this guy is still a little unaware of just how controlled he was. Feels like that was probably something he felt compelled to do. Says, I didn't think of the girl at all, except maybe to wonder faintly why in my present womanless state I hadn't made a pass at her. And I'm guessing sex isn't an issue yet, because what she needs right now is for him to get the photos out there. He becomes sexually attracted to her later. It's funny because he's going, I wasn't sexually interested in her at first. I think that's her doing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this shows that there is an exception, like stories in The King in Yellow, for the artist to hit on the model, because your expectation is that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that if you adapted the story in the current moment, the girl with the hungry eyes would be the hero, right? She'd be demolishing the lives of all these men who want to commodify and sexualize her.
He went to this place, Munch's Brewery. They were looking for a Munch girl, and Papa Munch was the one he had to sell to. So Papa Munch saw the picture of the girl, and he just said, that's the one. The photographer played it cool, but he was feeling dizzy again, which is strange because she's not even around. Maybe it's a lingering effect that she has on him. Yeah. So Papa Munch told him to have some beer to, like, feel better because, again, booze, it's for what ails you.
Always. Actually, a little beer is good for an upset stomach. Doesn't sound like it would be, but just a little bit. the carbonation. You know, it's good.
I think I said my wife's grandmother was prescribed Guinness when she was pregnant.
Yeah.
Because of iron deficiency.
It's got iron in it, yeah.
And the next stop was Mr. Fitch from the Lovely Belt Rose Colored Blotter. So he picked up on the girl out of all the pictures as well.
That guy asks another guy in his office, a married guy, to confirm his choice. The married guy's like, yep, that's the girl. I like her.
Exactly the same thing happened at Buford's pool and playground. So he's making all the rounds with these pictures, and everybody's interested in this girl. Mm-hmm. They all wanted more of her. So he ran back to his studio. He picked up the card that was supposed to have her name and number on it, and it was blank.
That's a weakness for the vampires, I guess, is that their writing doesn't show up on business cards. Weird.
So Pompamuch wanted her for a shoot the next day, but the photographer told him that she's sick. She can't do it that day.
Yeah, Much was suspicious. He said, I think it was some New York model, except I recognized your lousy photography. So I think this may be in San Francisco.
Yes.
He thinks, at first I thought you were stealing somebody else's work, but you're a bad photographer, so you couldn't hire me.
Oh, man.
Picture.
Over the next 5 days, he looked all over town for her. Modeling agencies, Pickup Row. Is that where prostitutes? Is that what Pickup Row is?
I assume.
And he even put an ad in the paper. Finally, on the sixth day, she walked in. Now, he tried to play it cool, but she seemed indifferent to him and his demands. Mm-hmm. He tried to play it off that he might have some work for her, but they would have to hurry to get it. And she told him, no, I'm in no hurry. And let me tell you how it's going to work. I'm going to come in here and only here. You're going to take pictures of me. And that's it. I'm not going anywhere. And I don't want anyone else to see me. Mm-hmm. You can imagine the roar I raised at that. I was everything. Angry, sarcastic, patiently explanatory, off my nut, threatening, pleading. I would have slapped her in the face, except it was photographic capital. But in the end, the photographer agreed, and so did Papa Munch after some complaining. Mr. Fitch also came around and accepted the conditions. So she came in the next day, they took some pictures, they got along okay, but there was something about her that made him feel like he was shoved away. When they finished the shoot, he was going to walk her down to the street, but then she laid out some more rules for him. I'm going down alone, and look, baby, if you ever try to follow me, if you even so much as stick your head out the window when I go, you can hire yourself another model. So that got him wondering, what's her deal? Wanted by the police? Someone's ruined daughter? The narrator comes to the present and says, you know, she's on billboards in Egypt now.
You know how modern advertising gets everybody's mind set in the same direction, wanting the same things, imagining the same things. And you know, the psychologists aren't so skeptical of telepathy as they used to be. Add up the two ideas. Suppose the identical desires of millions of people focused on one telepathic person. Say, a girl. Shaped her in their image. Imagine her knowing the hidden most hungers of millions of men. Imagine her seeing deeper into those hungers than the people that had them, seeing the hatred and the wish for death behind the lust. Imagine her shaping herself in that complete image, keeping herself as aloof as marble. Yet imagine the hunger she might feel in answer to their hunger.
It's so brilliant to set this in the world of advertising. And, you know, the parallels of vampirism are obvious.
Sure.
And the time the story's being written, it's right at that moment when advertising blows up as an industry, what they call the golden age of advertising, what's depicted in Mad Men, that Madison Avenue lifestyle. In these days, everybody's gotten a taste of being an advertiser, actually, because we're all on social media and we're all managing these social media lives. You know,
yep.
I hear people talking about, oh, I get this many more clicks when my kid's in the photo, etc. And when you post a picture of yourself looking good, you know, what do they call that? Being thirsty.
Oh.
The vampire thing is already, you know, it's implicit.
We're all thirsty at some point or other. Now, she never wanted any more money than the standard rate. When he tried to give her more money, she would just give a contemptuous look as if she were going to toss it down the first drain when she got outside.
Yeah, as we've said before, I think when we were doing those early Patton Oswalt episodes, you know, if somebody doesn't want money, there's a problem. That's the real, that's where the real horror starts to creep, because you go, this isn't normal.
Now Papa Much was really getting into her. His wife died a few years ago, and he would always look at photos of this vamp woman, whose name we never get, with sentimentality. And finally, he demanded meeting her. Dave said, look, I can't do that. We got a deal. Eventually, Papa Much got out of him when she showed up at his place to shoot pictures, and so he showed up 10 minutes before her. Now, Dave tried to kick him out, but she showed up as Dave was trying to get him to leave, so he hid Papa Much in the dark room. Before she came in the door of the studio, she just yelled, but not in an angry way, but just in a way that Dave could hear her. She said, get that bum out of there. I'm going up the next landing, and if that fat belly bum doesn't march straight down to the street, he'll never get another pick of me except spitting in his lousy beer.
Yeah, it's the only real exhibition of any powers other than her photographic magnetism. I mean, she could just sense that he was there, and she could sense his fat belly.
So Pompamuch came out all white, didn't say a thing, didn't even look at Dave. He just left.
Or maybe she saw him walk up there, you know.
So Dave eventually tried to hit on her a few times, but she only wanted a business relationship. And there was something about her that made it hard for him to let go. He says, I changed. I went sort of crazy and lightheaded. Only sometimes I felt my head was going to burst. And I started to talk to her all the time about myself. So lots of details about his life. Girls he dated, women he was in love with, a fight he once got into behind a bar. And he just talked and talked, and she seemed to only pay the slightest of attention to it. So Dave brings up the murders. Well, he's not sure you can call them murders because they seem to die of heart attacks. But people suspected that these victims were poisoned.
Says the six deaths created one of those mystery poisoner scares. And afterward, there was a feeling that they hadn't really stopped, but were being continued in a less suspicious way.
He couldn't put up with it, and he decided he was going to follow her after one of the shoots.
He made her work until after dark, then slipped out after her wearing rubber-soled shoes so he could be quiet.
He followed her as she walked, and then she stopped at a department store window. In the window was a display with her in it. A guy came up and looked at the display, you know, standing right next to her, and then he saw that the girl in the display was standing right next to him, and then he's taken aback. They talked for a bit, and then the two of them got in a cab together.
Says, how would you boys feel if you were looking at a poster of the girl, and suddenly she was there beside you, her arm linked with yours? This fellow's reaction showed plain as day. A crazy dream had come to life for him.
He said, I got drunk that night. It was almost as if she'd known I was following her, and picked that way to hurt me. Maybe she had. Maybe this was the finish.
Yeah, I'm sure that she knew he was following her.
Of course.
She knew that that guy was hiding up in the studio, she knew he was following her. Rubber-soled shoes be damned. But I like what she's doing, waiting for people to go look at her stuff and then creeping on him. I've actually been doing a little of this at the library lately. I'll see someone wearing headphones at a computer, and then I'll walk up behind them and just start giving them a little massage. Because, well, no, my assumption is that they're listening to the podcast. And when they turn, you know, then I'll kind of smile and be like, hey, I'm Chad Pfeiffer. So they can hear my voice and they'll know it's me. So far, 100% of the people have been listening to something else. So it hasn't worked out at all. But when it does, I think it'll be magic a little bit.
It will be.
And the cops will finally believe me that that's why I did it. For some reason, I have this running thing about doing messed up stuff in the library. I don't know why. But no kidding, this morning I was reading the news and somebody shot up a little porn video over at the library like a block away.
Oh my God.
Not the one in the park here, but over on Ocean Park.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that one. Yeah.
The city's really upset about it. I think it was during open hours.
Oh my God. How?
That's what I don't understand, because at first I thought it was at the public library downtown, which is pretty large. So there's lots of little alcoves and stuff. But then when I found out it was the branch library, like, I mean, I think
that's
a
tiny
partition in there to demarcate the children's section. But other than that, it's a big open.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Nobody should be doing that. It's a public library.
Yeah.
That's bad. Man, it made me laugh.
So the next day, she came in for work. That night, Dave followed her again. This time, she stood in front of a Munch Girl billboard. Another guy shows up, and it happens all over again. That guy was found dead the next day.
You know, in all seriousness, now that I'm thinking about it, you know, anytime Andrew Lehman goes to a screening of Call of Cthulhu, like people just disappear. I think he might be doing the same thing.
I'm trying to figure out how to make a joke of that. It's just a straight up accusation of wrongdoing. I'm not sure.
You correlate the contents. I'm not making an accusation.
Okay.
I'm just presenting evidence.
Yeah. Have you read any specific reports about people disappearing after screenings of Call of Cthulhu?
It's just rumors. I've heard some rumors on certain podcasts.
The thing is, the photographer doesn't really care that this guy ends up dead. The next day, she came in for work, and then she was going to leave, but then he hooked his arm around her arm to go with her. She says, you know what you're doing? And he says, I know. And she smiled. I was wondering when you get around to it. And it says, I began to feel good. I was kissing everything goodbye, but I had my arm around hers.
Women are weak, men are stupid. Right there. He's an idiot for doing this, and honestly, it's not a good decision on her part either, because he knows everything.
And he, for whatever it is that she's doing, she needs this photographer guy, so why is she getting rid of him? She should, obviously, in the story, she was having some ability to make him not attracted to her. Uh-huh. And that was the dizzy feeling. But then she kind of gives up on it, I guess. And then that's when he seems to get attracted to her.
I don't know. She has different effects on him. She made him dizzy. She's making him tell her everything about his life.
They walked down to the park and onto the grass. She pulled him down to the ground and he tried to undo her top. And she said, I don't want that. And then he says, you know, this is back in the bar, you know, and he's laying it down to us. Right. First, I'll tell you what I did afterwards. Then I'll tell you why I did it. Then I'll tell you what she said. What he did was he ran away. Not sure why, but somehow he knew that he was going to die and still had some instinct of self-preservation. Why was that? Obviously, he didn't want to die, and he knew what she was.
And this is what she said. I want you. I want your high spots. I want everything that's made you happy and everything that's hurt you bad. I want your first girl. I want that shiny bicycle. I want that licking. I want that pinhole camera. I want Betty's legs. I want the blue sky filled with stars. I want your mother's death. I want your blood on the cobblestones. I want Mildred's mouth. I want the first picture you sold. I want the lights of Chicago. I want the gin. I want Gwen's hands. I want your wanting me. I want your life. Feed me, baby. Feed me.
That's the end of the story.
That's it. Betty, Mildred, Gwen, these were all women from his past that he had told her about.
Yeah.
She wants his whole life. She wants everything.
So this story was first published in 1949.
Yeah.
It was adapted for the screen or the small screen as an episode of Night Gallery in 1972. There was a film in 1967. Directed by William Rotzler, and then again the film in 1995, directed by John Jacobs. And of course, there's the song Girl with the Hungry Eyes from the 1979 Jefferson Starship.
Yes, and then Hungry Eyes from Dirty Dancing, also yes. An adaptation of the story. What do you think the story's about?
There's a lot going on with it. It's definitely a horror story.
Yeah,
I hate to say addiction because it does seem like an addiction story where even though it's hurting him, he wants to give in to it. He wants to give up all of the things that he has just to experience this momentary pleasure.
Yeah.
And that seems like people are doing things that are against their self-interest just to be with her or near her,
right,
and to experience her. On the surface, it seems like that, but then it ties it in also with this world of advertising and how people use, right, other people for things as well. What do you think it means?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Look, the addiction thing is going to be in almost all of our vampire stories, but in this one, I think it's really prevalent. But I think it's primarily focused on the horrors of advertising and how it is a craft that is meant to add things to your life. The ads are offers, you know. Get this, it'll make you better. But the truth is, the proliferation of ads is making us poorer. It creates needs that maybe weren't there before.
Yeah.
It tells you that you're not good enough and you internalize these messages whether you mean to or not.
Yeah.
The more of it is out there, I think the more anxiety, fear of missing out, and depression people get. It's one of those things where it's not a matter of critical thinking to an extent. The stuff just gets to you.
Yeah.
You know, I've worked in that business and I think I'm pretty good at seeing and calling bullshit on things. So a lot of it doesn't work on me, but it does run in the background a lot and influence you whether you want it to or not. So
I think
the story is really more about, you know, advertisers aren't just trying to get you to buy the product. They want so much more from you. It's very naked when you're on the other side of it. They want you for life, you know. I think McDonald's is really the template of the worst advertisers in the world. And they really are the bloom of toxic advertising in the 80s when they said, we don't just want the people to come in for a meal. We want it to be attached to their feeling of home and family so that we don't just want the one customer. We want their children. We want their grandchildren. We want the child to bring their parents and their grandparents. So it was one of the first times when we went ahead as a culture and said, it's okay to advertise to children. Why don't you make the mascot a big clown and have everybody come in here, and it's a big fun and family experience. I don't know. Culture changed around that time, and it was because of advertising. See, this is the ranting I was talking about.
Sure, yeah.
But I think it's ultimately, you know, you have to advertise, and everybody does it. So there's nothing inherently terrible about it. It's just the preponderance of it, the data stealing.
Sure.
The dirty, you know, the micro-targeting, the different ways that, I mean, look, the ads you see on television, Those are the clean ones. They're announcing themselves as advertisements.
Yeah.
They're saying, yes, we're a 30-second ad. You know what this is, and I know what that is. It's all the more insidious ways that advertisers try to creep into your lives and target you.
Mm-hmm.
That's really dirty. In the internet age, this story is just as effective as ever. I think it's a great modern story.
It's been a wonderful March. I've really enjoyed our Draculas that we've explored.
Yeah, these have been really good Draculas this month. I want to thank our reader once again, Nick Vienna. Thank you, Nick, for jumping on the show.
Nick, you're a treasure. God bless you. And I also want to thank our patrons for keeping us going. Without their support and their personage in our crew, we would not exist.
That's right. And I want to thank a few of them personally right now, starting with Jake Droga. Thank you so much, Jake.
Thank you, Keaton Smith.
Thank you, Amy Yarger.
Thank you, Joshua Flowers.
Johannes Schmoll, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Arlie LaGrange.
Justin Raston, thank you so much.
Tail Coors, thank you.
Nicole Bennett, thank you.
And Jack Bragger, thank you so much for your support. You're all awesome.
For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.